Hi, everyone. A warm welcome to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for tuning in wherever you are joining us from. My name is Henrik, and we're based out of Sweden. If you're new to the program, check out redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Today, we're talking with Kingsley Dennis. He is a sociologist, researcher, and a writer. He's authored several books and numerous articles on complexity theory, social technologies, new media communications, and conscious evolution. Our topic today is his book, The Struggle for Your Mind. Hi, Kingsley. Welcome to our program. Thanks for coming on with us, first of all.
Thanks, Henrik. It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. Now, before we begin to talk about your book, The Struggle for Your Mind, and all your other work, I just wanted to ask you, I ended up looking at some of your photos there of your place down in Spain, and I read some of your story. I thought it could be interesting to just kind of go over that a little bit, of why you or how you ended up in Spain and why you wanted to go there.
Sure, and that's a good start, Henrik, because that's all part of my process. My background is actually in education, and I spent the last phase of my life actually teaching sociology at a university in Northwest England. Before that, however, I was working and teaching in Turkey, and I'd spent 5 years in Turkey, and I was also immersing myself in the local culture, and that is also the traditions out there as well. And I have this streak where I've been interested in the, let's say, the wisdom traditions from really all my life. So when I eventually arrived in England, I decided to focus on sociology because I wanted to look more at the structures of what's going on in the world and try to correlate that with my own experiences and my own processes and to see if I could make something from that. So what happened is that over the years, I was teaching about social systems, complex systems, and really about global models and globalization and global technologies. And more, I wanted to look at the subjects which, for example, I've explored in my own work about conscious evolution, the human mind, and how that relates with social processes. So the bottom of it is that I came to a point where I felt I was obstructed in doing what I wanted to do because of the normal constraints of academia and academic publishing, where you have to toe the line. And also, I'd been researching about peak oil and, let's say, that the carbon societies, which was actually my first published work on looking at a post-peak oil society. So I put that all together, and I thought, really, I want to, put myself where my mouth is and start to think about my life priorities. That is, downsizing, stepping back from the system, trying to be more self-autonomous and self-sustainable. So what I did is I decided to take a leave, and I ended up in southern Spain, and the plan was to look for a plot of land, look for a place where I could start to develop myself, grow my vegetables, live a life closer to me, where I didn't have to be a part of the commercial world that I had been in, and to give myself some time to write what I wanted to write and see where it took me. And at the end of it, if it didn't work, I'd look for plan B. And I haven't looked back, Henrik. I've been here and I've been publishing and living, and I realized that it worked. That was the groove that was right for me.
So have you kind of, I don't know if that's the right word, but have you gone the hermit route a little bit?
Not at all. In fact, I think I've found that the world has opened up. Because, of course, you need to be in a place where you're connected with people worldwide and globally. So if I'm here and I speak with people daily across the world through the internet and what we're using now,
yeah.
I'm connecting with a lot of locals. I'm connecting more with the local community. In fact, what I found is that my previous life, although it seemed on the surface more connectivity between people, really I felt there's more superficiality as well. And that's because of really the the subject of conversations, the resonance you have with people. You know, I probably didn't realize until I stepped out of academia what kind of bubble you're in. You know, it's going back to the Orwellian newspeak. You all have to speak this consensus language, you know?
Oh,
what
yeah.
they call it the peer language. You have to get published in peer-reviewed journals. Basically, you have to write and publish and talk to people who very few other people are listening to, you know?
Yeah.
So it's quite inclusive. And what I started to do is publish some work on the internet. And the feedback I got from that, from people actually reading this stuff and really wanting to speak about it was so much more valid and of so much more depth than I thought, well, here's a publishing world which is really where we need to engage with. So it's the level of engagement which is totally different.
Let me ask you a little bit more about academic consensus and everything else. And you mentioned that you have to toe the line. I've always found this very interesting because science, as it is then, is very strictly, well, it's driven by whatever the collective is doing in a way. It has that format, as you say, with being peer-reviewed and everything else. And if someone doesn't manage to replicate what you state or whatever, then basically it's disqualified by default. Yet it has been driven, the principle, the scientific principle, as far as I understand it, have also been driven by individuals who have fought the norm all the time, that they've tried to, you know, push the boundaries into new territory, and despite that it's been not accepted by the majority, later on it's been proven right, and then these have been individuals who have been driving this. Yet every time a new idea comes in, it's automatically fought off, if you will. What do you make about that? How's that happened?
Well, that's true. You know, we're talking about the anomalies here, and we're talking about the anomalies, whether they're Galileo or Rupert Sheldrake. They are few and far between. And what we do realize is that the people who tend to speak out, they don't do it at the beginning of their career, because otherwise they wouldn't have a career. And so the more you go up the career ladder in academia, the more a person tends to find they have the flexibility to speak out. So usually it comes later. And what we also find, and what I've found, is that the environment today is even more constrained than it was previously. So it would be a good question to see how many anomalies are cropping up now. Especially, for example, I'm talking about the UK, because that's where my experience is. We have universities especially are very much autonomous, business-driven commercial entities, because we have the top-up fees now where students are paying, which means that the parents or the students expect to pass at the end of it, and therefore it's almost a product. You enter a commercial deal and you expect to receive the product at the end. That's a commercial transaction. And also, because of that, universities are constrained to be able to publish top of the league tables with almost no one failing, because how can they attract students or aka business clients if they have a less percentage of success? So therefore it's virtually impossible, and I'm sorry to say it, in my experience, to fail a student unless they just don't turn up or they don't exist, because it affects the league tables. And also, what you're publishing has to fit in with the RAE rating, therefore the academic star rating, because that pulls in extra funding. And so you're almost handed a list and told you must publish in these peer-reviewed journals, because those are the ones which are recognized by the rating standards and will give you the points that we're looking for. And so you find yourself being dragged into the system almost unknowingly at the beginning, because it just seems that that's the way of the career. It's very hard to see when you're in it that it's a consensus system which is very dense. And so these anomalies are usually people, and to give them great credit, who find a greater flexibility once they start to move through it, and also are given more leeway. So the question is, if these anomalies are coming out later down the career or in the system, you know, what great minds are we punching through the consensus holes earlier on? We need those minds to have creativity straight away. And that's a system which is becoming more ingrained as education becomes more a commercial entity.
we have, of course, more to discuss than this particular topic, but if we linger on it for a little while longer, I think it's very interesting. One question is, of course, how these publications achieve their as the rating standards, and of course, and you know, why there are few and far behind this network, if you will, expanding. I mean, you mentioned Rupert Sheldrake. His work has been ferociously resisted, and a lot of people out there who call themselves, you know, rational and everything else, you know, these atheistic, materialistic scientists, you know, completely just driven by sensory perception, are, you know, attacking his works, because I think it's ending up on this boundary where it's still scientific enough to be, of interest or importance, but then at the same time, it opens up this whole new area, which is very, very scary to a lot of people, I think. And it's just interesting that he and some of his peers are attacked on this level. What do you make of this, Kingsley?
Well, I it's not a surprise that they're being attacked. You know, the old adage is that unless you're being attacked by, you know, several thousand voices, then you know you're doing something right. So the fear in those voices who are trying to protect the status quo, that's understandable. From my point of view, and people like Sheldrake and others, they're walking a fine tightrope. What you have to do and what they have to do is build up a certain level of credibility first, which is what Rupert and others have done, is that they've published beforehand. They have credible rating. They've done their work. They've proved themselves. And so it's a lot harder for the others to shout them down. Because if you start to say this straight away, then you're immediately trashed and put out as what are they talking about? What do they know? So it's important that a person who wishes to really raise the voice above the consensus is able to have some credibility or validate themselves, because it helps them. So, and that, you know, that's almost meaning that a person plays the system to begin with, therefore it gives them some ammunition before they turn around and start to voice these anti-systemic truths or these ideas. And also perhaps for many of us, we all grow up playing the system as well. And it's not a bad thing, because it's all about learning to be social. So, and this is one of the things which I talk about, Henrik, is that the social environment exists, social conditioning it exists, the human ego it exists to help us engage with our fellows and be a part of society. The point is, what point do we get to when we realize it's time to really think for ourselves and really start to bring our own voice out? Some people never get to that stage, and when we do, you know, we have to use all we have, all our baggage, our intelligence and credibility, to really make our voices heard. And so we do need some self-ammunition, really.
Well, indeed. I think this will tie into what we're going to, you know, continue to talk about here as well. In a way, it's an appeal to authority, one of the most common fallacies that people end up in. They do basically go for the established order instead of, you know, using their own minds and hearts, for that matter, and thinking for themselves and coming to their own conclusions. And in many cases, even people who are just exploring these ideas, too, are the ones who are attacked. And it never has to do with anything that, it's believed 100%. But these are people who are, you know, investigating and taking their own time to exploring it. But nonetheless, if we switch over to The Struggle for Your Mind, your book, and maybe first we can kind of set the preface there a little bit. And tell us what you mean with that title and what you incorporate into The Struggle for Our Minds.
Yeah, Henrik. Well, what I came to realize through my studies in sociology and my general research is, which is not surprising, I think many of us and many of the listeners and people you speak to realize the same, is that there's a small group, which may call themselves the elite, dominating others, i.e. the masses, generally without trying to exert sheer physical force. So they create an unnoticed and often willing consent to a hierarchy of power. And that hierarchy of power is generally referred to as the social norms. So The Struggle for Your Mind, the title, refers to that moment when someone wakes up and realizes that they have been part of this unnoticed consent and decide that it's time to break the spell, time not to play the game or play ball, and to start to think for themselves. And that's when, as we've just talked about, the trouble begins, when you start to, the nail stands out and the hammer comes down. So is that kind of, let's say, disturbances, which I talk about in the book, as well as the techniques that keep the mind down. So the struggle for your mind is about taking back our thinking patterns from the matrix of willing and often unnoticed consent, Henrik.
Consensus, again, we're back to that word. Within society, there exists a silent war, you mentioned in the book, and this, you know, basically as a battlefield. You incorporate a lot of different things in this, but what I like to go back to a little bit is what you, how you perceive that this was enforced to begin with. I've always found this question very, very interesting. If it's true, we have to take that position as well, I guess, if it's true that we didn't have this stance from the beginning, if we haven't been controlled, if you will, from day one at the dawn of human consciousness, if you will, how did we end up in this situation then?
Yeah, that's it, trying to take it back to the origin. You know, what I always try and say, and what I try to outline in the book and when we're speaking now, is that this social management hasn't always been done to be nefarious. That just the very practicality of having a complex human civilization requires a certain degree of social management. So, in fact, that's built in to human civilization. It's built into human thinking patterns and human ideologies. So, if we go far back to early civilization and just think about the priestly castes and how they really held on to their knowledge or their channel of information and didn't share it, and so everyone else were really under the power or the ruling authority of those who knew. So, Henrik, it's all about information and knowledge and who has it and who shares it. And so when that goes on, you know, the priestly caste can go on to orthodox religious human structures. That can go on to political structures. It's a small group of people have knowledge and information, and they don't wish to share it. So we can see how the printing press, the Gutenberg printing press, of allowing the massification of information, of Martin Luther nailing the theses of the Protestant ideology on the church door and starting the Reformation, how that was a revolution. It's all been about information. So really, what we've come to is human civilization and society that's so complex and now expanded to such a degree, and especially with technologies, and that's a major element, is the techno-culture that we now live in, is that this element of how is information controlled, who controls the distribution of it, and what is distributed, and therefore what is fed into the human mind. It was fairly easier before, in the sense that people were really took on board what was told to them by those in authority, because the masses and their thinking patterns was limited to what they were told in their small communities. The situation now is that we are now connected with a global information system. Information is spreading unprecedented amounts in different levels, that this has come to a point where it no longer is just a needed requirement of human civilization. It's come to a point where it's actually manufactured. So the probably to answer your question is, what was the point when this social management of information shifted from being a requirement just to have social management of the masses in order society to roll on, to a point where it's been manipulated and manufactured to really keep the masses down? At that point, I can't pinpoint when it happened, but I think really we have to look at a point where human societies, especially the industrialized societies, became really just unprecedented growth and technologized. Just to give an example, Henrik, especially in British societies and with the older lordships and serfdoms, the way to control people was very visual.
Yeah.
If someone stepped out of line, they got put into stocks in the local square or hanged in the local square, and that was a pretty good signal to everybody else. These days, most societies either can't get away with it or realize it's not that efficient, because it's all about efficiency. So therefore, how do you try to control people's behavior in a way which isn't visceral or overly physical? And that's the way, is through information human consciousness. The tipping point, I can't pinpoint it, but it has to do with really the technology, the complexity, and the masses being connected and being literate.
Well, it's interesting. It's turned kind of into a mental prison, and it's what Huxley talked about of being in favor for your servitude, of actually ending up in a situation to enjoy it. And we'll work ourselves up there how that happened as well. But if we again look at the many of the native cultures in Europe, the Gauls, the Celts, the Goths, the Visigoths, the Lombards, the Alpines, I mean, the list is endless. It goes on and on. But many of these people had knowledge about things in their environment, of nature, about how to heal, what to eat, how to eat it, herbs, food, what have you. They could sustain themselves. They knew about the movement of the stars. In some cases, they had their own science there, if you will. But if we look at the the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages specifically, we realize that this was practically all this knowledge was practically gone at that time, or absorbed into what I think is the elite at that time. What do you think was driving that? And again, I mean, there was a lot of genocides of different peoples as well. To what I see Kingsley as trying to eradicate this knowledge and basically, take it off the face of the earth. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree without a doubt. There's been cycles of civilization where knowledge is being contracted and often disappeared or even went underground, and then times where it flourished more and it had, let's say, the energy to help it flourish. So you mentioned the Dark Ages, for example. That was a time when really any information or knowledge was basically disappeared. I feel it was taken into the monastic orders. You had a huge growth of these monastic orders, which were almost like citadels or city-states, and knowledge was confined there, and there was pilgrimage where certain monks would connect with the other monasteries, and information was shared, but it took centuries before that kind of information was released again. It was almost a kind of holding pattern. Now, you mentioned again indigenous knowledge. That most definitely has been deliberately wiped out. And what I would say, and you probably agree with me, is that a lot of this indigenous knowledge, this shamanic knowledge, they had knowledge of the extended mind, of the information fields where the human body, the human nervous system or mind would connect with a larger field, and therefore these informational fields would cross over, and knowledge was known instinctively. So there's a difference between Gnostic and instinctual knowledge and acquired knowledge. And so this eradication of Gnostic knowledge, and to bring it into a rational, linear mode, whereby we lose that ability to connect inwardly with an instinctual Gnostic channel of information, and to replace it with an externalized channel of information where it becomes acquired. And therefore, where do we acquire it? Well, we acquire it from institutions that were deliberately established in our cultures, which initially were called workhouses and now we call them schools, to give out the information which certain cultures require for people to be able to fit into the consensus. And that has always been the three R's: reading, writing, arithmetic. And so, so that's been eradication, I feel, of instinctual knowledge. And that rationalization was very heavily developed through the Industrial Revolution. And, the workhouses brought people in to teach them just enough so they could go out into society now. And it's very similar with our educational structures now. The curriculums You know, we get taught within the four walls. And, you know, you know, in my day and age, if I talk to my partner or anyone on my desk and say, you know, let's talk about this, your hand got slapped. It got called cheating. You know, today we're trying to call it collaboration. But the old paradigm is you can't share. Everyone has to work individually. So therefore, they constrain your mind into a competitive, every person for themselves type of thinking. And that's very typical of the rational, technocratic, linear mindset. And it's totally opposite to this instinctual, collaborative, and extended mind, which was held by the indigenous and the shamanic people in it.
And yet it's about regurgitating the same information. So although they've managed to kind of isolate that, it's still about the consensus of the collective that comes out of this Prussian, you know, school system that we've seen. So it's an interesting kind of contradiction in itself there, that it seems to be about an individualized path, but at the same time, that's not what it is at all. It's simply about isolating it and to realize that these people who are working within it basically have to regurgitate the same information, but they're on their own, obviously, in terms of memorizing it and everything else. But, you know, despite that we today then have the perception that we've built up our knowledge base again, you know, we have the scientific principle, it's taught in these schools, but it's strictly theoretical in most cases, as you say. Our understanding about anything practically is very, very limited. But this seems to have been the plot, if you will. This seemed to have been how they wanted to build it up, right, Kingsley?
Sure, and going back to my experience at university, you know, I truthfully had students coming to me and saying, what do you want me to write for your essays? And I would say, well, you know, write what you feel, write what you believe in. And they turned around and said, yes, but if I wrote that, I'd fail. Tell me what I need to write to pass. So you know, they knew that they had to give what was accepted. And, you know, I try not to play ball, but that's, you know, that's another thing. And so what's been happening now is really, as you say, an individualism which cuts off creativity. And that's why I think the time we're living in now, this transition time, is so critical, because a lot of, you know, there's a lot of young minds now, and they're instinctively, they're feeling this something doesn't resonate, it doesn't click, and there's an instinctual grating or non-acceptance of this very artificial curriculum. And so what's happening is that the school system in a lot of places, and this is very marked in the US, is that they're responding by saying that the students have this attention deficit or some kind of syndrome. And they've got a whole list of syndromes as long as your arm. And so they try to believe or make believe that this is an anomaly and it should be squashed. And so that again is trying to deal with those people who are not fitting into a standardized system. And so I feel that this is going to be developing more and more young minds and young hearts are going to be realizing that they can't play ball with this system anymore. It just doesn't make sense. And that sense of dislocation, at the moment, it's playing out as frustration. What needs to happen is that frustration needs to be channeled into younger generation realizing that, in fact, they can be right, and what they instinctively feel must be expressed, and then not to have that fear that they're going to be seen as failures or anomalies or pushed drugs. And you know, and that's that time now we're moving into, and that's why I feel that it's such a critical and I say exciting moment, but it's something that we have to deal with.
I say that modern societies are basically they're limited in or limiting our consciousness to keep, you know, humanity obedient, but also distracted from their inner lives pretty much. And this standardized system, then, it seems like is also, as you explain here, kind of crumbling. It's falling apart. It doesn't work anymore. For many hundreds of years now, they're trying to keep it in a certain way and do it a certain path and all that, but it seems like it's kind of falling out of their control. Some people have speculated that that's also one of the designs, actually, to kind of take people backwards, that even the education that we were given at some point also now is failing, if you will. But I do believe, as you say, that there is also a natural, organic, if you will, resistance to it, because, you know, the soul of most human beings know that something is wrong with it, right?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, you're right when you pick up on that, is that it's now beginning to fail. And, those people or those powers that are setting this up, they know this very well. And that's why things are getting even more distracting. It's like, you know, the drowning person goes for the desperate last gasp and tries to bring other people down with them when they go down. So there's an awareness that this system isn't working. So I think they're upping the ante. They're trying to increase the distraction. And it's definitely what you say, is that they're trying to distract people from themselves. So I make a kind of tongue-in-cheek joke by saying, you know, they say we live in 2013 AD, anno domini, when no, we're living in 2013 attention distraction. Is that that's what it's all about, with not only the media and all the content, but the mainstream, whether it be the mainstream social institutions, whether that it could be families, education, orthodox religions, the law, all these social institutions are trying now to really strengthen the distraction and strengthen the social norm. And a lot of the dialogue we're having with, you know, people like ourselves and others you have on this show and people listening, we're saying that, you know, this is a conspiracy and this thing is going on. And the more that I realize this is that, in fact, it's the conspiracy is the social norm. It's so normalized. And that's why it's so difficult to speak to other people, because it's ingrained within us. And so it's more difficult to speak to the older generations who are so conditioned. And I'm not criticizing everybody, because we're all conditioned. It's a normal part of socialization. And it's, you know, and it's very difficult to come out of it. And so we have to really, you know, I think we have to, you know, give due credit and kudos to those people who are waking up, because for some, they don't have a natural alarm clock within them. And therefore, we have to give out these pieces, these books, these talks to try to be part of the alarm system. But what I sense is happening is that a lot of the younger generation are growing up and they're getting it a lot quicker. So it's almost as if they've got some hard wiring which is picking up this kind of illusion or matrix much quicker. And that is quite encouraging. And so when the younger generation especially, but not only all of us, are moving over to this internet and social media of distributed communication, it's very interesting how the old hierarchy is very vertical. It's very Masonic. You know, you have to go through step one to step two, yep. And it's very compartmentalized. Whereas what's happening is that a lot with the communications and the younger generation, they're utilizing this decentralized system, which is, you know, the networks, the grid, getting behind these one-on-ones and going into multiple interactions, this multitasking. And that's the energy, really, which is feeding this empathic mindset, this coming together, which is then feeding this, I would say, the instinctual side of people, which is really the Achilles heel of the authorities. And so the internet and our communications is the Trojan horse. It's the Trojan horse which is within the system. And so just to put a final point on that, I would say that, and I often come back to the words of the great visionary Buckminster Fuller, where I paraphrase him when he says, you don't fight the system. To bring a new system into being, you create a new system which makes the old models obsolete. So rather than a headbanging the wall in front of you and headbanging the system, we have to work a way of getting around the wall within the system by making new models. Because all we're doing is, by headbanging, we're giving the authorities a reason to erect higher walls. We have to be clever in that. We have to transform the system from within. And I think that's happening, Henrik.
Definitely. Now, you know, when young people are born into the world, we're hardwired to figure out what the world is about. How do we try to fit in? How can we become popular and be liked? And this is something that's moving, as I see it anyway, moving like an unseen force through the group. No one really understands, let's say, why someone is popular, why something is liked, but everyone's trying to achieve it, everyone's pushing it, attaining that center point, if you will. But to counter this, as I've seen it, is that we have to learn to stand on our own and dare to stand against the social norms, as you said. The path of the true individual is one who has the ability to kind of reject this out of hand and truly begin to think for themselves. One who's, who at that point actually had the ability to begin true interaction with other individuals who are not driven by this unseen ghost of the group mind. And when you have that kind of collaboration between people who have attained a certain level of true individuality, then that can grow into something really, really strong. I've seen that before, and that's just incredible. You know, when you have people who are not, you know, conformed like these little cubes that forms a wall, but true individuals who have something more, an energy to bring to, you know, to the collaboration. What do you think about that?
Yeah, sure. So it's, you know, we have to start saying, I'm not going to play ball anymore, and really start to walk away. So it's that stage where we can actually come to a point where we can say it. Now, originally, I the title of the book that I wrote, I called it Taking Back Our Minds, to have that kind of image of saying, no, I'm not going to play ball anymore, I'm taking my mind back, thank you very much. And the actual publisher said, well, if you call it that, people may think you're telling people they've already lost their minds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they have to change it around. Because, I mean, it's all around us, this obedience to authority. And it's ingrained within us. And you're probably familiar with the Stanley Milgram experiment.
Oh, yeah, sure, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, and I think many people are. It's so ingrained in us that anyone who wears a lab coat or anyone who has this uniform of authority, we're nodding our heads and we're doing everything and to please them. And that's ingrained as well, I think perhaps from infanthood, is that we're ingrained in this wanting to be given approval. And that infancy has stayed with us. So on television now, if we have some actor wearing a lab coat saying, this washing powder works, something in our subconscious believes it, because that's ingrained in us from infancy. And, interestingly, there's a study which I want to bring up. It's called, it's called Psychohistory.
Mm-hmm.
And have you heard of that?
No, I've not.
Right. And I think one of the major exponents of that is a scholar called Lloyd DeMaus, D-E-M-A-U-S-E, Lloyd DeMaus. And he studied history through really applying psychology to politics, culture, and warfare. And he looked at it for about four decades. He's been studying this. And his hypothesis is that really the ills of culture and society and our fear of freedom, which many of us manifest, really comes from this, let's say, psychological infancy, which we still have within us and which culture, supports and ratifies and tries to encourage. So, for example, he looks at politicians and the language they use. So when the atomic bomb was dropped over Hiroshima, of course, it was called The Little Boy was written on it.
Yeah.
And the message that was sent to Washington as a signal of his detonation was called The Baby Was Born. And To take this further, there another investigator called Carol Cohen, she wrote a paper called Sex and Death in the Rational World of Defense Intellectuals. And she actually worked with them and studied with them to find out how they behave to each other, how they operate. And she found this psychological infancy built in to many of these almost what we would call geniuses. So, for example, She notes how when the Ernest Lawrence sent a telegram to the physicists, again developing the bomb, he said, "Congratulations to the new parents, can hardly wait to see the new arrival." And they talk about everything in terms of people's babies.
Yeah.
And so he's saying that this maturity really it shows infantile behavior, which is part of the cultural conditioning because we want to be accepted. We have this fear of freedom. So I think Stanislav Grof talks a lot about this, in that really if we can't deal with this inbuilt or subconscious fear of freedom or the fear of psychological death and rebirth, then we're going to manifest it outwardly. And so that, I feel, is something which, as you rightly said, this distraction doesn't allow us properly to engage with our inner world, with ourself, to mature as inwardly on a self-evolved level. And so, you know, if you go back to Maslow and hierarchy of needs, you know, the goal is self-actualization. But of course, before we get there, we have to look after our early comfort zones, which are food and sex and nurturance and shelter. And so that's where the distraction lies, in those early needs. So if the distraction can be sexual stimuli, can be, you know, putting a roof over our heads, i.e. the false economy and the debt system, and all this need of acceptance, i.e. the basic levels, then we don't have the luxury of self-actualization. And that's more or less the bottom line in what's been going on, is that this conspiracy or the artificial social norms have been focusing and distracting people and society onto these very infantile basic psychological levels. And so it's very difficult to have the luxury to develop our inner self-actualization. And that is what's changing now, hopefully. And that's the kind of critical tipping point we're at in this.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's so many different aspects to why people accept this servitude and the way they do it. I mean, one interesting thing is why people defend their captors as well. The Stockholm syndrome. There's a reason that term comes out of a country like Sweden, where obedience has been engineered into the cultural identity. And this, of course, comes after a tremendously violent, bloody, and suppressing history that no one learns about today. But there's been a lot of theories why this, you know, psychological phenomena arises in people, the Stockholm syndrome. Do you have an explanation to this of why people, you know, end up defending those who are, you know, enslaving them pretty much?
It's this attachment that really what we really require, as I mentioned, is this acceptance. And that's why this social conditioning breaks us down in early childhood, and then gives us new models, which generally those models start at school, which are the teacher figure, and therefore that continues into civil servants, going back to anyone with a lab coat, anyone in signs of authority. But also, because they do that obedience, really they miss out a part of humanity which is central, and that's love. The need to feel that we're wanted and we're connected with. So this Stockholm syndrome is that we're putting a situation where it's quite critical, and we often don't know how to act. So we return to this. The real fundamental need is that we need looking after, we need love, and often then we connect with that with the nearest people or anyone which shows a sign of affection. Now we can go back to, for example, there's a recent series on that's doing very well on terrestrial television called Homeland. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, I've seen some of that.
Yeah, right. And you know, the initial stages shows, well, how did they turn these so-called U.S. soldiers, where it was putting someone into such a terrible confined critical state, and then, as the U.S. soldier Brody admits, someone finally came along and showed some tenderness, and that was a way of turning. So, you know, this does exist. But if we don't have that connection to a nurturance or love, then what happens is that many of us, without knowing it, we start to ratify and give credit to a type of social psychosis or what you may call psychopathy. So, and this has been well studied, and I'm sure you're familiar with, and many other people, is that social psychopathy has become a type of norm which we see in politics and the major institutions like economics, because then that behavior starts to be given kind of role models. And again, going back to studies, there's now a field, strangely enough, called neuroeconomics. And what this does, it takes a combination of cognitive neuroscience, psychology, and economics to look at people's behavior. And there's been a published report in Psychological Science where these researchers, again, lived amongst some top economists, and they did a study, and they found out that those economists which have, a sense of an ability not to show emotion, they refer to it as a lack of emotional responsiveness. And even they tested it with people with slight brain damage, I have to say, people who could not show a sense of emotional connection. These people who had closed off their emotions, they were the people who were best performing in economics, because they took the decisions, the high risks, which they would not care about the consequences or the consequence on human action and on how people would be affected by that. And they showed that this behavior was the atypical behavior which was benefited, which was lauded, and even given promotion in the economic establishment. Now, it probably doesn't come as any surprise, does it, that those institutions that function best may be functioning on a form of functional psychopathy.
Well, it's interesting here too, you know, Kingsley, is that the responsibility here is also given up, because obviously the reason why these people are put in charge, why they are the ones who can make these, you know, quote unquote tough decisions, right, is because everyone else can also reap the benefits from it. Let's say the shareholders or what have you, that they want to sit on the sidelines and benefit from it, but they are not the ones who want to do this evil behavior. But they want to benefit from when someone else is doing it. So the responsibility here, as well as I see it, is the majority who kind of silently sits by and allows this to happen without actually having a good, you know, wholesome person taking control of the situation. Do you see what I'm getting at? There's a play here, you know, between those who are capable of making these decisions and then those who are sitting quietly at the sidelines and accepting it, reaping the benefits from it.
Yeah, and that sadly has been the case for too long, and that has brought us to where we are now. But often those people who saw it or who were able to had the capacity to understand how this functional psychopathy worked, they were few and far between, and they couldn't. It was very difficult maybe to have a voice in the world because there was not the platform to announce that, or they couldn't connect with others very easily. Because really, before globalization or before global technologies, we were very much cut off or very difficult to communicate. So, what I refer to as the Tesla syndrome is that Tesla, the great scientist and innovator, you know, he was hounded to a poor death because he couldn't really get out there and connect with other innovators so easily. He couldn't get funding other than the military who really, squashed him. So now what we're doing is that we have the ability to have disruptive innovation, or what I like to think of as a massification, is that people can connect much more easily. These people who realize what's going on and they have a voice or they have an innovation, they can connect with others a lot more easily and they can have the voice. So what I feel is happening is that, and this is the positive constructive side of it, is that whereas before the system could engulf or swallow up the dissidents much more easily, or whether put them in a Siberian concentration camp like they did in the past or whatever, it's very much more, it's more difficult now to deal with the anomalies if the anomalies can act quicker and to spread their information quicker through these such networks. And therefore, how do you stop a rising tide when they can, it's a perfect metaphor of the internet. The internet was created, as you probably are aware, as really a communication model that would survive a nuclear war, so it could reconnect and find other pathways. Now, you know, that's another notion of the Trojan horse, that this system was basically given to people eventually to operate within the social structures, and that now is being used to connect people together, and it's empowering people from within. And that is going to be part of, I think, the answer, is this massification. So to give an analogy, you have a piece of blotting paper, and it's one color, white. That's the color of the social norm. That's the social conditioning and the consensus. If you put one drop of ink on that, all you have is one drop of ink. It doesn't affect the color. That's how it was in the past. These anomalies or these change agents would try to stand up, and they didn't have a great effect in changing the system as a whole. You put a second drop of ink on that, not much really affects the color. You put a third drop, a fourth drop, a fifth drop. Eventually, those drops on the blotting paper will start to spread and spread and spread. Once you have enough drops, they will all connect, and before you know it, the blotting paper has changed to a different color. That's the exponential effect that we have. And I feel that's what we're going to happen, is enough people connecting, enough people standing up and being the change agents, that they will connect. And we may have an eureka moment when the system will really be a different color or on the verge of tipping over to be one, Eric.
All right. Well, I want to talk more about these change agents, as you say, the biological evolution, you know, what that is, the emerging mechanism for neurogenetic evolution. And then there is you make some interesting connections to the electromagnetic changes in the sun, etc. There's much more to discuss here. But let's take a little break here between our segments, Kingsley. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about your website and for you to give that out and also mention some of the other titles of your book. We've been, of course, primarily talking about The Struggle for Your Mind, but you have a lot of other titles out there as well. You've written some with Irvin Laszlo, as I believe. So please go ahead and mention some of these.
Well, the website is under my name, Kingsley Dennis, so kingsleydennis.com. Or if you just Google me, you'll find me. One of the benefits of having an unusual name. So on the website, really, I have a lot of articles or blogs that I regularly update, and these blogs are not published elsewhere, so they're just downloadable to really get an update of my thinking. The books that I have now, for example, what I talked at the beginning of the program about me just leaving the academic system and going to Spain, the first book I wrote here, which was a test of whether I'd stay or go, was called New Consciousness for a New World. And that was the book that predates Struggle for Your Mind. And the Struggle for Your Mind is really follows on from that, but looking at the more of the social norms, whereas the New Consciousness looks at the larger cycles of evolutionary change and social change. The other books, I co-edited a book with Irvin Laszlo called The New Science and Spirituality Reader, which brought 20 authors together, such people as Greg Braden, Bruce Lipton, Deepak Chopra, Barbara Marx Hubbard, and really people who were advocating the spiritual thinking and those advocating new science, and tried to show the correlation in the new dialogue, where in fact it's not a duality. The new science and spirituality are really saying the same thing, but just through a different language, and trying to bring the two cultures together. Then I have a book called New Evolutions for a Small Planet, looking at the larger cycles of energy and communications that are happening now in the world. And to bring us up to date, I've just published a co-authored book with Irvin Laszlo called Dawn of the Akashic Age, which Akasha being an old Hindu Vedic word referring to the underlying energy of the universe, what we may call the quantum energy or quantum vacuum, and really making that a metaphor, or these days it's not much of a metaphor, it's an underlying truth that the quantum sciences are showing how our distributed lifestyles are bringing us together in a kind of Akashic connectivity, and how would that be down the line in 2020 and even looking towards 2030 at these new models of change with this connectivity. And we asked certain people like Charles Eisenstein and John Peterson and Dwayne Elving to give their thoughts again on changing economy, changing media, about how we're coming together in the future. So it all is about consciousness and people, Henry. That really is a prime pivot, is that we can't really have great change until we have a change of consciousness. And the change of consciousness has to come through the people, because it's not going to come through politics or the government. So that is, you know, that's where the focus is people and consciousness. That's the bottom line, two words, people, consciousness.
All right, very good. KingsleyDennis.com. We're going to have the link up on RedIceCreations.com. Please check it out. Stay with us, Kingsley. We'll be right back after a short break.
Thank you. kept it down from the day you were born. There's no need to apologize for the riot in your eyes, 'cause some days you think so
Alright everyone, we'll continue with Kingsley Dennis in the second hour. We have much more to discuss, but some of the things we'll talk about is normality as a conspiracy. We discuss control through sexuality and the dawn of the internet and ARPANET. And then later we get into conscious evolution and the connection to solar activity. Sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com and continue to listen to the second hour and of course all of our previous programs are available right there for you as well. Our next program is Radio 314, and then at the end of the week we have a somewhat different program for you guys with Tjeerd Andringa from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He is a researcher in cognitive studies and artificial intelligence, and we are going to talk about the limitations of bureaucracy and then further extend into authoritarians versus libertarians. Some interesting stuff there is coming up. But we'll continue right now with the second hour together with Kingsley Dennis. Right around the corner, we'll talk to you there.